Welcome to Nevada Newsmakers. On the broadcast today, Ray Hager and I speak with State Senator Joe Hardy, plus on the Power Pundit panel, Mary Lau, Fred Locken, and Jesse Wadhams. It's all coming up next on an all-new Nevada Newsmakers.
The signs and symptoms of cataracts can start out small with subtle changes in your vision. So don't wait. Be proactive and take your vision into your own hands. If you're experiencing the onset of cataracts or just have questions, contact your eye care professional or call Eye Care Associates of Nevada today. Dr. Hiss has years of experience specializing in the surgical correction of eye disorders and has completed over 84,000 vision-correcting procedures. At Eye Care Associates of Nevada, we'll change the way you look at the world.
Hi, my name's Marilyn Miner, and I'm sure you'd agree that Nevada's a very special place to live. I was born here, and my husband and I have raised our family here. I feel it's a privilege to live and work in the Truckee Meadows. I especially enjoy helping my clients reach their real estate goals. Sometimes the smallest details provide the greatest satisfaction. I'd be complimented to talk to you about your next move.
Call Marilyn Miner at Dixon Realty, 742-1280, or log on to marilynminer.com.
Nevada Newsmakers coverage of the 2017 legislative session is brought to you by Pro Group Management, the Nevada Trucking Association, the Nevada Franchised Auto Dealers Association, and the Retail Association of Nevada.
This is Nevada Newsmakers with host Sam Shan, a no-holds-barred political forum. Now, from the Nevada Newsmakers Broadcast Headquarters, here is Sam Shand.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we're always pleased to welcome back to the program State Senator Joseph Hardy of District 12. Pleasure to have you back on the program, sir.
Good to be here, Sam.
On a very rainy, snowy morning in the middle of April.
Yes, we're going
Carson
to get
City,
some rain.
To say the least. I wanted to ask you right off the bat, there were hearings yesterday on the Death with Dignity bill. You were very much opposed to this last session. Where do you think this is heading this time? Because Tick Sagerblum, for example, is saying that this thing is likely to sail through.
Well, I think nothing is ever dead, if I can use those words in relationship to this bill. Obviously, it's been put off, and it's been put off, and it's been put off, and it's been put off. So from a legislative standpoint, you always wonder when it's actually going to come up. And I'm not going to be able to predict when that's going to come up, but I suspect there's enough people who are involved and want it that would like to see it happen.
And where do you think the governor sits on this?
I don't speak for the governor, and I haven't asked him specifically. I have my own views, obviously.
And you're very much against it still, I'm presuming.
So it's called physician-assisted suicide, and I'm a physician, and I don't believe in suicide, and I don't believe in helping other people commit suicide. I do believe in helping them through their pain, palliative care and hospice. I think those are things that we have all recognized work and help people through that and allow the dignity that happens with death. And so I don't know that you have to have a bill that requires a person to commit suicide in order to have dignity.
Okay. Doctor, there's been a lot of talk in the last couple of months about the opioid crisis in not only Nevada, but across the nation. And do you think doctors have been unjustly vilified in prescribing pain pills, medication, in this crisis?
Well, I'm a doctor, so this would be a time where I could whine and say, oh, yeah, it's not the doctor's fault. The reality is it's a multi-pronged challenge. We have a culture that required the physician to say, are you in pain, as a vital sign. In other words, every time you saw a patient, you were supposed to ask, are you in pain? And then you were judged if you did not alleviate the pain. And that process of judgment, otherwise known as surveys, still happens. So the emergency room physician, for instance, they survey the patients. And if the emergency room physician has not alleviated pain, that's one of the questions in essence, and therefore you're judged on that. So there's still a situation where people are saying, he did not remove my pain. And that concept of removing pain acutely is different than the chronic pain. And chronic pain is where we get into the challenges. So every person that we put on acute pain medicine is literally at risk to have chronic pain. That is because when you come off of your addictive opioid medicine, you can have a virtual reality withdrawal, and that brings you to a pain situation. So it can build upon itself. It's not something that the doctor is alone in this as much as I guess it's a philosophic, I should not have any pain ever. And there are other things to do than opioids, obviously. And chronic pain is one of the things that we're trying to deal with and help, because as everyone is aware, people who have chronic pain who are given opioids may indeed overdose and have problems. The challenge, one of the challenges we have now is if we take that person off of their opioid, then they say, well, I still have pain, so what am I going to do? They go out and buy their heroin. And heroin is unpredictable, and those people have problems, and they can overdose very easily with their heroin, particularly if they have a benzodiazepine that they've been taking for whatever reason, whether that be for anxiety or in complement for their depression.
You mentioned virtual reality withdrawal. What does that mean?
So if you have an opioid that you've been on for some time and you stop it, then you're going to have the real symptoms of pain, agony. You're going to sweat, you're going to feel miserable, and you're going to say, this is horrible, I am going to get something so that I do not feel this way. And so the withdrawal leads you then to do things that you wouldn't normally do.
Would you like to see a limit on the amount of pills that somebody is given for pain in the initial dose, so that they are forced to come back to the doctor and hopefully you can prevent more people from becoming addicted?
It's a great soundbite to come back to the doctor. We don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough pain management doctors particularly. So you're coming back to the doctor in 7 days or 10 days if you still have pain, which is a wonderful concept because I'm a doctor and I can use that return visit. But the bottom line is, how are you going to fit those people into the system that's already too skinny on the amount of doctors that you have? So yes, if you give a month's worth of opioid prescription for something that traditionally is going to last for 5 to 7 days with pain, maybe not even that, then you've got this medicine hanging around. And some people feel that if a doctor writes a medicine, they're supposed to take it. And if they're supposed to take it, they keep taking it. And lo and behold, by the time they're out of their month's medication, they're hooked. And so there is an advantage to prescribing less, which brings me to the other huge issue. There are actually people who have chronic pain. There are people who have rheumatoid arthritis, for instance, that you're not going to get rid of that pain. And so the opioid does have a benefit for those people. And so, you know, we all have patients who have been on opioids for literally months or years, and they're stable. They don't steal car stereos. They do their things, and they come back every month, and they get their prescription, and they're on a regular basis, and they're fine. They're functional. They're able to do their things. So it's not a matter of, quote, just giving fewer medicines as much as giving the medicines that are needed when they're needed for as long as they're needed.
And do you give a warning when you're giving these medicines to say to the patient, potentially, if you abuse this, you could be in serious trouble?
I think that's an excellent thing, that when we start looking at treating patients, we need to look at the prescription monitoring program. For instance, I say, I'm checking because it's the law. I'm checking and I type in the prescription monitoring program while I'm seeing that patient, and I'm saying, I'm seeing if you are on medicine, because I have to do that, and we check. And so we, in essence, are every single new person that's on an opioid, or if we increase the dose, we have to check that, and I do that right while I'm sitting in front of the patient.
More with State Senator Joe Hardy right after this.
Your business workers' comp company should be your partner. The Pro Group customer care team brings you effective risk management training, support, and web tools at no extra cost to you. We maximize the safety of your employees and business every day. Pro Group is with you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with information and resources at your fingertips. We ensure your employee safety and that your premium's in line. When you're a Pro Group member, you have the team that's looking out for you. Pro Group Management, workers' comp that works for you. Call for a no-obligation quote today.
Nearly 200,000 Nevadans work in retail businesses, supporting families and the community. Nevada's retail businesses generated over $2 billion in sales tax revenue in 1 year, including nearly $700 million to help our schools. Shop around and see all that Nevada's retailers offer our state.
We're the Retail Association of Nevada, representing thousands of Nevada businesses.
Businesses that work for Nevada.
This is Nevada Newsmakers.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we continue our conversation with State Senator Joe Hardy.
Senator, you're a co-sponsor of AB 200, which would force schools to let parents know if other pupils are skipping vaccinations for religious or other reasons. Do you think, where does this bill stand? What are your thoughts on it? You know, thoughts of... the chances of getting it passed.
Thank you, Ray. I think realistically it has nothing to do with the exemption as for whatever reason, but it has everything to do with the child who is immune deficient. So if a child is immune deficient and the parents do not want the child exposed to diseases, then that parent would be able to call the school and not say which student is religiously exempt or for whatever reason, but is there a student who is not immunized? And so, you know, we all live in the world where measles does happen and pertussis does happen and all of those kinds of things do happen. Pneumonia does happen. So all of those things can be, and chickenpox does happen. So all of those things a person can be immunized against. And if you have, in essence, a bubble boy situation or somebody who is not immune competent because of whatever reason, either genetically or because of being treated for cancer and killed their immune system, then the parents would be able to say, is it safe, in essence, to bring my kid to school? And if there is a child, and it doesn't have to identify who that is, if there is a child who's not immunized, then I would like to know that so I know it's a risk and I'll keep that kid home, and you know, and I know that you can do homeschooling. And that's the, in essence, I don't know if it has the legs, I'll call it, to pass, but we'll know tomorrow evening if that does, because that's the deadline for all bills to pass.
So it does, it hasn't been out of its, it hasn't passed its first house?
I don't think it's passed out of its first committee yet, but again, that's in the assembly, and I've had enough to worry about with the Senate bills that I haven't had to put myself into the assembly situation very much.
Well, which is the Senate bill that's most concerned you?
You know, it's interesting you ask that, because what we've seen from the very first of the session was what we call the blueprint, which is the Democratic National agenda, I'll call it. And so there are bills all over the place that have been taking up time and energy and the print and the paper and the et cetera, doing the blueprint for Nevada, they call it, but it's the national agenda for the Democratic Party. And so there's not, quote, a bill as much as the bills that have come one after another in committees that we will hear and we will discuss. And then I keep thinking, so when are we going to get to Nevada? And what are we going to do with Nevada? And I mean, we heard a bill yesterday from the majority leader that was talking about financial planners, and I kept thinking, you know, this is something that is part of the agenda, much like the sanctuary city, much like the minimum wage. All of those kinds of things are marching down and taking the time to do things. So I and two other legislators came over here to the Secretary of State's office and talked with the people who actually know what's going on, and saw that bill and that was the financial planners, and thought, wow, this is going to affect over 100,000 people, and the Secretary of State's office was never contacted and said, how are you going to implement that? And that's kind of what you see right now. You see the blueprint national agenda happening without the input from the people who know how to implement things in the state of Nevada.
And that's where we have to leave it. State Senator Joe Hardy, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Please come back.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back.
How do you shed some light on a better economy? Start with growth inspired by Valley Electric Association. We're a member-owned power company that puts Nevada first, and we're doing big things, like providing prosperity by securing renewable energy projects. For Nevada, that means more jobs and more opportunities, all for a strong statewide economy. In other words, together, we're doing powerful things. Visit us at vea.coop to learn more.
Early in the morning or throughout the night, professional truck drivers are on the job, serving you, safely moving freight that's crucial to our economy. From the oldest industries to our newest innovators, from the exotic to the everyday, trucks are everywhere, moving everything. Never afraid to embrace a future that makes Nevada and our nation stronger. Trucking moves America forward.
Nevada Newsmakers coverage of the 2017 legislative session is brought to you by Pro Group Management, the Nevada Trucking Association, the Nevada Franchised Auto Dealers Association, and the Retail Association of Nevada.
And now, back to Nevada Newsmakers with Sam Shad.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we have a great Power Pundit panel. As always, Fred Locken is here, the political scientist from Truckee Meadows Community College. Mary Lau is president and CEO of the Retail Association of Nevada. And Jesse Wadhams is off counsel with Fenimore Craig. So State Senator Joe Hardy, talking about the Democratic national agenda. Is this really slowing things down here, or are we just at a slow period at the legislature anyway?
That's an interesting question, Sam. I think the honest answer is that there is a slowness to the process. I think the rollout of the sort of macro concepts from the Democratic blueprint, they've kind of taken these weeks of themes. And unfortunately, when you have 120 days, you don't have a lot of weeks to work with. So I do think things appear to be backloading to the end of session. I mean, the number of exemptions that are coming, the number of things, policy issues that are rolling over into Ways and Means and Finance, we're starting to stack a lot of policy to the back end of this process. And, at some point, the dam's going to break.
Mary, is the dam about to break?
Oh, it's not about to break yet, but the problem is there is a bunch of bills that will die tomorrow by midnight. And then we'll see what's left over. But I totally agree, because there's been so much staging that they really didn't keep track of what was going to happen in Nevada. When you articulate a program and you choreograph a dance, sometimes you forget you're in a Broadway production. You also have other things going on. And their leadership is going to really have to bow down and burrow into their committee chairman to get things moving. So much of it's been theater. Now, like Jesse said, we have to get to the policy.
I think it also points out the problem with term limits, because there's such a lack of experience, especially in leadership, in understanding what the pace of 120 days has to be, that it's just another collateral thing that wasn't thought about when somebody came up with the bright idea of term limits.
Well, I see, the way you folks are talking is that I really see a logjam at the end of the session, and the Senate Majority Leader, who is toying with the idea of running for statewide office, either governor or attorney general. If things don't end on time, how does that impact his probable candidacy in 2018? Mary, can you?
Well, I think the majority leader is dealing with a lot of issues on that. It's not going as smoothly as he wanted. He has managed to avoid some of the Roberson barbs, but they still get to you. And he has some bills and stuff from his more progressive side that he's going to have a difficult side moving his caucus into a more moderate position to get bills signed by the governor. Because if it comes out straight party line, then that's shoving it down somebody's throat and it's not a policy decision. So Senator Ford is in a very difficult position, and he's having to master that and also consider his career.
Jesse, what do you think is better for him, governor or attorney general? Or?
Well, far be it for me to map out Senator Ford's career for him, but I do think that, you know, he's a pragmatic guy. He's very thoughtful, very bright. So I think, you know, honestly, he could probably make a nice pitch for either one of those offices. I mean, typically one doesn't jump straight from state senator to governor, but there's more of a sequence. So, but I think he'll be pretty pragmatic and sort of think his next step.
And Dina Titus was talking about Steve Sisolak as being the one to run for governor on the Democratic side.
I was going to say, though, that it again also points to a design flaw. We are in the business of special sessions now because 120 days, even in the best of circumstances, if it was orchestrated at the quality of a Broadway play, is not enough time to serve the needs of 3 million residents. And these are all the cues, all the reminders, every cycle, telling us that we really need serious reform in the legislature.
Mary D.
But how does Texas do it, Fred? They're
not
biannual,
well.
And they still manage to function. And Dallas has more than
yes.
our membership does, yeah. It's an interesting status, and it's interesting that it happened, but you're not going to repeal term limits, and we've had term limits for, 12 to 16 years now, so get over it, figure out a plan, and stick with the plan. We're not going to put that toothpaste back in the tube, and we should.
But doesn't that mean that we continue to have the all-powerful governor then?
Well, a governor should be powerful. But look at Susan Martinez in New Mexico. She just made the Gibbons and Sandoval veto pen look like it ran out of ink. I mean, and she has line item veto. I mean, she just defunded the legislature and told them they have to come back into special session. Now tell me how that's going to work. I mean, that governors in all 50 states are very, very powerful, or they wouldn't be governor. You know, it's fun to be the CEO of the state, and it depends on your lobbying team and everything else. But, you know, it didn't switch the power to the governor. The governor's already had the power. And when you had strong leaders like Senator Raggio, he supported his governor, and that was the role that Roberson took last session. So if it's the governor isn't from the same party, then he has to be a strong CEO.
You get the last word.
Well, I think you're seeing the confluence of both term limits and 120-day session. I mean, every other year. The problem is either one of those things is probably a minor problem and needs reform in the overall scheme, but both of them together make for a difficult session that we are starting to see.
And that's where we have to leave it. Thank you all very much. We appreciate it. We'll be right back.
St. Ives Florist, for every holiday and every special occasion, for romance, custom home design. We have the largest selection of fresh flowers in Northern Nevada. And we also offer a large selection of unique gift items. Come see me, Lori Ann, at St. Ives Florist, 700 South Wells Avenue, or call me at 333-9190.
Sully's Sports Bar inside the Tamarack Junction is South Reno's headquarters for locals to watch all your favorite sports. And now you can enjoy your favorite team on our brand new high-def TVs featuring the Papa, the big daddy of them all. It's our giant 17-foot big screen TV wall. And we have two 79-inch high-def TVs, 12 65-inch high-def TVs, including two party booths for your own private party, and six high-def private booth TVs. Bring in your own headphones and listen to your favorite game right from your own seat. First, make your bets in our William Hill Sportsbook, then enjoy your favorite cold beer, libations, burgers, wings, pizza, and our signature build-your-own Bloody Mary bar. Then settle in and download our app and listen to any game being shown in Sully's Sports Bar. Catch your favorite team on our new high-def big-screen TVs. Sully's Sports Bar is the only place to watch your favorite sports all year long. The Tamarack Junction, just north of the Summit Mall in South Virginia.
It's Tamarack Junction, your junction for fun.
Among the guests on the broadcast next week, State Senator Scott Hammond and the return of Dina Titus. We'll see you then.